Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue to talk about pipelining and look specifically at how we're going to turn our single cycle processor that you'll be building in HCL2D in a couple weeks for homework into a pipeline processor that, if we knew what our cycle time was, would actually be faster. And last time we looked at a subset of this, looking at how we would handle data hazards with stall. So we had our processor, which only did adds. And we had this case where we had one instruction that wrote to register 9, and the following instruction wanted to read from that. In our single cycle processor, this wasn't a problem, because those would happen in different cycles. But in our pipeline processor, ordinarily, the actual write to the register would happen before the following read would. So our easiest solution was to delay the execution of the second add instruction by inserting dummy instructions twice into the decode stage and so on. And we needed two types of logic to do this. So first of all, we needed to not advance the PC when ordinarily we would. Secondly, we needed to insert these no operation values, this dummy register number 15, in order to make sure we don't accidentally change some values when we're waiting to be able to run this second add. And let's look at what the logic for that might look like. So to not advance the PC, that means sometimes the input to that PC register is going to be the actual incremented value. And sometimes it's going to be the old value of the PC. So we have a mux something like this in front of the PC, and into that mux we need to give a signal which says whether or not we should stall. So this is something you might set in your HCL based on, say, the opcode. Similarly, we had these registers where we passed a value from the fetch stage about what register numbers to use to the decode stage. And in that case, sometimes we want to pass the real value, the register we actually got from the instruction memory. And sometimes we want to ignore that and pass 15, our no-op value, to tell the decode stage, please don't do anything. I don't have any work for you yet. And we also need some control signal. That's probably going to be based on what opcode we're running and some other logic we'll talk about later today. That's going to decide which one of these we want. And we're going to call the idea of sending this no-op value, sending a bubble. So a bubble in the pipeline is something which takes up space but doesn't have anything in it. And that's going to be what we're going to call the no-work values we send down the pipeline. So these two muxes are things you might imagine that you might have to write in HCL2D, but it turns out you won't. And that's because for every single register bank, HCL2D has these muxes built in for you. So all you need to do is specify those two control signals, and they're going to be called bubble and stall. And we'll talk more about this later, but you should know that this is a built-in feature of every single register bank in HCL2D, because HCL2D is designed to make it easy to make pipeline processors where you'll need to do this a lot. But you could implement it without that, just a convenience feature. So any questions about these bubbles and stalls? Or anything we covered last time about the pipeline processor? Or with the simple pipeline? Yes?
So stall is for PC in
this case? So stall means that we don't change the value. So yeah, that's what we want to do for the PC. Yes?
Do registers also stall? They just maintain old value.
So this would be the way you make a register maintain the old value. The register is going to always take whatever this input is. So there needs to be some logic like this around the register. In the case of HCL2D, it's built in, but there needs to be something like this, the way our registers work. So let's move on from our simple only doing adds processor to adding pipelines to our entire single cycle Y86 processor. And basically, most of the work is going to be just taking our processor diagram and dropping some pipeline registers on it in the appropriate places. We're just going to drop some registers in between where each of our stages happen. And everywhere we put a register, that means any value crossing that line needs to go into a register and come out of a register. And we have four banks of registers from this. We have between our fetch and decode, between our decode and execute, our execute in memory, and our memory and write back. And the rule is just that every value that crosses those lines goes in one of those registers. So there's one little detail that we do need to fix. So with the way this is drawn right now, we have this wire from the write back stage to compute the next PC. And if we let that go, that means that the instruction that's four instructions behind us is going to decide what instruction we fetch next, when we actually need to make the change right away. When we have a jump instruction, we want that to change what instruction we run next, not what instruction we run in five instructions. So this is not acceptable. We're going to need some extra work to make that happen. So in most cases, we can just compute what the next PC should be right after the instruction is fetched. So if you look at an unconditional jump, you can know what the target of the jump is immediately. If you look at a call instruction, you know where to go immediately. If you look at just at the instruction in memory. And for other instructions, if you look at the opcode, you know how long the instruction is, and you have exactly the logic you implemented for the last lap. There's two exceptions, and those are conditional jumps, JE, JNE, and return. So for return, the address of that we want to go to is in memory. So somehow we're going to have to get a signal from this data memory into this logic here. But a problem is that the way this is laid out, we're going to get that four cycles too late. So we're going to talk about what we're going to do about that. And we'll also talk about where we get the signal for what conditional jumps. When can we actually know the answer for those? So any questions about this general layout? Okay, so let's talk about the stages of our pipeline. So we've gone through these before, but now instead of the stages being kind of advisory, so it doesn't quite matter exactly what stage everything's in, now they're going to be quite real. Because something's in a particular stage if it uses those pipeline registers. That's how you know what stage something's in. So if you're using different pipeline registers than you're supposed to, you moved an operation from one stage to the other. And we're going to need to define exactly what stages something's happened in that we've perhaps glossed over earlier. So one thing is that we, instead of having a separate PC update stage, most of our PC computation is going to occur in the fetch stage. That's the design our book has chosen. But we're going to have some stuff which is elsewhere, and we'll go over that more later. So we also have to talk about where condition codes are read and write. And our book has been careful in specifying the stages to do that always in the execute stage. But it hasn't been important until now exactly where that's done. The reason we're going to need to do that in the execute stage is because this is going to avoid data hazards. So the execute stage is the earliest time we know what to set the condition codes to, because that's when we do, for example, the add, whose result we're going to use to identify whether to set the ZF flag or set the SF bit. And therefore, we went to the earliest time we can read the condition code safely, in the worst case, is going to be in the execute step of the following instruction, because that's the cycle after they've been written. So our general rule will be that we'll just always read and write the condition codes from the execute step, and we'll never have to worry about reading an old version of the condition codes if we do that. So we also have our stat register. And you've written code which sets the stat register. And typically what you've done is you've looked at the iCode from the instruction memory. And for example, if that's halt, you set the stat register to halt. Now if we did that, we would halt the processor immediately when we fetched the halt instruction, even though there might have been some instructions before it which are still, for example, in the executed memory stage, which haven't finished. So that's not going to be acceptable. So therefore, we're going to need to actually write the stat register in the write-back stage, because that's going to be after every single instruction before the halt has actually finished its memory and write-back stages already. Yes? Don't want to hold unless we're done. Yeah. Unless other instruct. Yeah. I conveniently didn't move the slide. Okay. So we're going to always write the stat register in the last space, even though, as far as we know right now, we know exactly what to set the stat registers to in the fetch step. Just because it has side effects that we don't want to occur until after everything else the instructions have done is finished. Okay. So as I mentioned, we're slapping pipeline registers. Yeah, sorry.
Wouldn't it be good to know the stat, if there's an invalid instruction or something as early as possible, though, so you won't execute more instructions?
Yes. So there will be reasons why we will want to look at the status of instructions before we actually update the stat register. What the status should end up being. We'll talk later about the general concept of dealing with that, at least. So we are going to need that, but we're not going to actually update the stat register because that's externally visible state. But we'll have to keep track of that information somewhere. Okay, so we added these pipeline registers. And our book has a particular naming convention for these registers, which is perhaps not the best choice, but we'll use it to be consistent. And the convention is that the inputs to the registers have a name starting with the lowercase letter of the stage and the outputs of the registers have a name starting with the uppercase letter of the stage. So for example, F_RA is the RA pipeline register that is written by the fetch stage, and it's the value being written by the fetch stage. D_RA is the value coming out of that register for the decode stage to use. And this is the notation the book uses. You can use this easily in HCL2D, the way you write your registers, or you cannot. It's up to you. So with that notation out of the way, let's look at what's going to happen in our full processor around this PC register. So the logic we know so far, what you did in lab, is that you get your PC, you send it to the instruction memory, and based on the iCode, which you get back from the instruction memory, you increment it by some amount. And you wrote this in HCL2D, so hopefully you're familiar with basically what it looks like, how you actually turn this MUX into HCL2D code. And let's think about, what code like this generally looks like throughout our processor. So I'm going to get back to expanding this PC update MUX to handle our other cases, like jumps and returns. But to do that, we're going to need to talk about how this sort of code is going to end up changing as we have multiple stages in our pipeline. And this can stay the same, but there's other cases where we're going to need to do more work. And I'm going to look at an example of some other logic which is very similar, where instead of choosing what to increment by, we need to choose whether or not memory reads or writes. So this is in the memory stage. It's the same sort of thing. We need to choose whether we want to send a 1 to the memory for reading or a 0. And It would seem that you do that with almost the exact same pattern of code that you used for the PC update. It's just that instead of having PC plus 2, you have 1 or 0 for this memory read signal. But in our pipeline processor, if we wire this right up to the instruction memory, we would be reading the up code from the instruction that executes 4 cycles after our memory instruction. So that instruction would decide whether or not we read or write from memory, and we'd be reading in cases where we shouldn't be, and not reading when we were supposed to be. So that would give us the wrong answer. So instead, we're going to need to get that value from a register that stores what was previously read in from the instruction memory. And because this is in the memory step, this register is going to have to give us a value which came from the execute step. And that's not where we read it. So that execute step has to get the value from the decode step. And there needs to be another register. And eventually, this goes back to the instruction memory that we read several cycles ago. And you'll notice that this logic that you definitely are going to need to implement doesn't appear on our picture of the processor. And it doesn't appear in most of the book's pictures of the processor layout. But it does turn out that we need to send this opcode signal in order to do all this logic. And we're going to need it even to handle RPC updates. So that means in order to implement our do we read or write memory logic, whereas in the single cycle processor, we can do something that looks pretty much exactly like what we did for PC update, where we have, we set the signal we want, which is mem read bit in this case, and we just look at the I code, which was just what came out of the instruction memory. And sometimes we give 1, otherwise we give 0. Looks like, basically the same pattern. But we can't do that because this I10 bytes is the I10 bytes for a completely different instruction than the one that's actually running in the memory step. Yes?
So 2 lines of 4?
Yeah.
And that's acceptable in ACLTD?
I hope so. If not, you can write ORs in HCLTD, yeah, okay. Hoping we have that much C. So in our pipeline processor, instead of having this code, we need to have a whole bunch of registers specified. So we're going to set a register input from the instruction memory. And we're going to pass that from the fetch stage to the decode stage. Then we're going to pass the output of that register in the decode stage to another register, and so on, until we eventually get to the memory step, where we'll have our input into one of those pipeline registers for the memory step, which will tell us the opcode of the instruction in the memory step, and not the opcode of whatever instruction several instructions later we're currently fetching. And that's what we'll actually use to decide whether or not we're reading memory right now. Questions, comments about this? Okay, so the general rule you should see from here is that we're going to need the opcode everywhere. In every single stage, we need to make a decision based on what kind of instruction are we executing. So even though it might not be shown on our pictures, where we're only showing where the data goes, to make decisions, we're going to have to pass the I code through pipeline registers for all the stages. And this is going to be useful because we're going to need to make decisions later about, for example, stalling and PC update, where we're going to want to know what's executing currently in other stages of the pipeline. So we're often going to be using the I code, which is passed in registers, through all the pipeline stages. So another rule you should get is that there's a general rule about how we're going to build our pipeline stages. And for the most part, you should only use the prior stages outputs. Otherwise, you're getting something from the wrong instruction. So each pipeline stage is sort of an independent program, which takes some outputs from the prior stage, which are going to be in probably a single register bank. So for example, the D underscore I code, if you're in the decode step, and sets inputs for the next stage as its only output besides whatever sort of functional unit is inside the stage. So the write back stage has the register file inside it, so it's going to change things there. But the only other externally visible stuff is going to be through the inputs for the next stage. So in the decode stage, these values descend to the execute stage with, for example, the registers we just read. And there are two exceptions to this, and that's going to be most of what we talk about for the next week. So one of them is deciding what instruction to run next. For what instruction to run next, we actually want to send information from one instruction to the other, because we need to, the other instruction, we need to decide what it is. And it needs to know that based on looking at some other instruction. So in that case, we're going to violate these rules because we actually want to share information between instructions. And the other case is dealing with hazards. So hazards are things which only happen because we're executing multiple instructions at the same time. And to reason about them, we're going to need to think about what instructions are we running at the same time, and we're going to need to look at signals from multiple instructions in order to do that. So those are the two cases where we won't be obeying this rule of only looking at our neighbors in the pipeline. But for the actual logical work the instruction does, that's all we'll do. So I mentioned that we have iCode in the instruction in the pipeline registers. So let's look at how you're going to figure out what else you need to put there, besides just looking at the book and assuming it's right. And one way of doing this is we can look at our book's sort of descriptions of what happens in each stage for the instructions. And these are going to give us a kind of imperfect view of what we need to put in pipeline registers. And you can say, OK, so we're using RA here. Where does that come from? Well, RA is part of the instruction. And for some reason, we didn't write down where RA and RB come from the PC memory at the PC, but that's where they come from. So that has to be passed from the fetch stage to the decode stage, since we're not allowed to use any other inputs to implement the decode stage. So it must be in the pipeline registers. Similarly, we write val A and val B into code. And then we use those values later in execute in memory. So those need to be passed in pipeline registers, because we aren't allowed to get the value elsewhere in the execute stage or in the memory stage. So we know that, for example, to get the value to the memory stage, both the stages in between need to pass it in their pipeline registers. And similarly, we can see that val E needs to go in a pipeline register. So you can enumerate this for all instructions and figure out the full set of things you need to put in pipeline registers. And let's look at another example. So for add Q, we similarly need to get RA and RB, but we also write RB all the way in the write back stage. So we need to pass it through all the stages. We have the same rule with val A and val B, just as with push Q, but we just don't have any fuse it in the memory stage. And val E needs to go through the memory stage into the write back stage. Now, yeah.
Isn't this val A plus val B?
Yes, it is supposed to be val A plus val B. Okay, so if you look at what the book's descriptions of what's in the pipeline registers in the figure in the textbook, you'll notice that they don't have come to quite this conclusion. And they do something a little bit different. So here, we're using RB for the write back, and that's usually how the description is written. But the book instead computes something called DEST, our input for our eventual input for the register file, but it's not going to be sent until the write back step. And that is passed through to the write back step instead of RB. So there's clearly no information lost by, you know, passing RB instead of DESTY or vice versa. Because given RB and the I code, we can compute DESTY anywhere. We can always know, looking at the instruction, does this write to RB? If so, then DESTY is it or not. But it is handy to have elsewhere because it's going to be helpful later on, when we talk next week about data hazards, to know, oh, does the current instruction being run write to a register? That's going to be a useful thing to look up, and it would be nice to be able to write that code in your HCL2D as what's the value of DESTY, not is the instruction a add queue or a push queue, pop queue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and what is the value of RB for it. And so that's why the book passes this DESTY in registers and DESTM similar, rather than just passing the register number directly from fetch all the way through. Both would work, but this is going to be simpler for the logic we're going to have to implement and write in HCL2D. So any questions about this? What we put in pipeline registers? If not, let's finally return to computing our program counter based on not just incrementing the instruction. So we have our simple case where we just need the information in the instruction to figure out what the next program counter is. And that's for instructions where you go on to the next instruction, calls where it's just in there in the data we get from the instruction memory, we can just copy that, and unconditional jumps. So we have our two hard cases. That's conditional jumps, where we have an address in the instruction, but we don't know whether or not to use it until we look at the condition codes. And we have RET, where you need to look at memory. And as I mentioned earlier, we can't, in the worst case, possibly know the value of the condition codes or in memory until we let the previous instruction have a chance to rewrite memory or write the condition codes. Because in the worst case, that might happen. And at the time we're fetching, the previous instruction hasn't gotten that far. So it seems like we're going to have to wait, that we can't act immediately for these two cases. And from how we talked about dealing with data hazards before, this is a control hazard, but it's the same idea, we're probably going to want to stall. So let's look at what stalling is going to look like here. So let's say we have a subtract instruction and then a conditional jump. This subtract instruction changes the condition codes. So we can't know, executing this jump, whether or not it's going to be taken until the subtract instruction finishes its execute step when the condition codes will be written. So until then, we're going to need to wait. And the way we'll do this is that we'll run the jump in the pipeline as a normal instruction. We'll send it down the pipeline, we'll give it a decode step. It's not going to do anything in the decode step, but we're still going to send it to the decode step. And we're going to give it an execute step, and it will do something in the execute step. And it's going to read that condition code register there. And when it's executing to read that condition code register, it will compute whether or not the branch is taken. And in the next cycle, we'll have that information available in order to decide to fetch this I remove queue instead of something else. So what's going to happen here is that our sub queue is going to set the condition code register, and that's going to give our jump instruction in the execute step the information it finally needs to know whether or not the jump is taken. And then we're somehow going to send the information from this jump instruction into the fetch stage, so we can finally stop stalling and execute the next instruction. So let's look at how this is going to change our PC update logic to have this be implemented correctly. So we're going to start with our simple PC update logic, where we just add something and convert the I code. And we're going to add a case where we're going to take the address of the jump target and in case where we're going to stall. So for the stalling case, we're just going to wrap around this old value of the PC and send that back in. For the other case, we're going to get the jump target from the instruction memory, and we're going to send that in. And since we have a choice to make, that must mean we have a mux. So we're going to have a mux right after this PC increment. So we have our stall case at the top, and we have our take the jump case at the bottom, and the middle case is the normal one where we just go to the next instruction as usual. And we have to have some control logic, which is going to take some input. We'll talk about what exactly that is. And that information from the execute step that was derived from the condition codes about whether or not the jump is taken. Questions, comments about how this looks? So if you read the textbook carefully, you may notice that this disagrees with how our textbook decided to arrange the PC update. So they made a change, I'm not quite sure why they felt it was really important, where they don't actually do this computation before the PC, but they move the second mux after the PC. So it looks something like this. So instead of, so this PC register, instead of containing the actual PC, it contains what they call a predicted PC. And that's the PC assuming you just execute the normal next instruction. And then they fix that up in this, with this mux here, which is just before the instruction memory. You could have done it earlier, but they decided not to. The sort of intuition is you want to make the decision as late as possible to give you the most information. But it's not really going to change anything. So to be consistent with the book, this is the diagram we're going to deal with. So instead of having a PC register, we're going to have a predicted PC register, which is going to contain the normal next PC. But we're going to have this mux in front of it in the cases when we have an unusual next PC. Yeah?
So this is what they meant when they say you're calculating the PC at the beginning of the clock cycle, not at the end?
Yes. So here they're calculating one version of the PC, and they're finishing the calculation at the beginning of the clock cycle. Okay, so let's look at what the logic that's going to feed this needs to look like. So first I should mention here. So this jump target here needs to come from a register now. Before, we just got it from the instruction memory. But if you do that now, you're in trouble because this goes to the instruction memory and that's a loop and that will never actually convert into value. So you can't do that. So there needs to be some register that stores the jump target we expect in order to implement this way of calculating the PC. Okay, so let's look at the simple thing. Like, how is our taken signal going to be computed? That's one of the inputs to that control logic, which decides whether we stall or use the jump target or just go on as usual. So that's going to be in the execute stage, because that's the time when the condition codes, which are the inputs with some logic to this big mux here, are going to be set. And we also need some other information. So we need the function code, that is the condition code bits from the jump instruction, to know what condition are we testing for? Are we looking for zero flag being true or not? And because our rule for coding a pipeline stage is we only get information from our neighbor's pipeline registers, that better come from our neighbor's pipeline register. So I'm calling it E_ifunc because that's the value that was passed to us in the execute stage from decode. And that eventually came from the instruction memory. And given that, we're going to use this and compute whether or not the branch is taken. And since the fetch stage is going to use that in the next clock cycle to compute it at the beginning of the clock cycle, we're going to store that in a register. It's going to look like one of our pipeline registers, but instead of being read by us in the memory stage, it's going to be read by the fetch stage. And that's okay because we actually want to communicate to the next instruction, about what address it should use. So that takes care of deciding whether or not the branch is taken and providing that input to the control logic. But we haven't said how to know whether or not we should stall. and you know, whether the signal is being computed for a jump instruction or for something else. Because if we have this logic in our processor and we execute an add instruction, yeah, we can run this for an add instruction. It's going to compute something. It's going to decide that there's some signal here, but we just won't want to use it. So we need to make sure that control logic only pays attention to this when the jump instruction actually got to the execute stage, and not while we're, say, running the previous add instruction there. So let's look at our timeline and think about the values of our pipeline registers. So I mentioned that one thing that's going to be really handy is that we're going to pass the opcode through the pipeline, because we need it all the time to make decisions in every stage. And it's also useful for control. So here, the input to the that the fetch into the registers between fetch and decode is JXX. So by checking whether that input is JXX, our control logic can know, oh, I'm somewhere in the middle of executing a jump instruction. And after we sent the jump instruction to one stage, the decode stage is reading JXX from its pipeline registers. And we could just peek at this signal. When the decode pipeline registers for the opcode say it's a jump instruction, that means we've gotten that far, that we're one cycle into executing the jump instruction. And that means we should stall, because we're not done yet. And similarly, when the execute register say it's a jump, we can look at the pipeline registers there. And when that output says it's a jump, that means we should still stall, but we are to the point where we're actually looking at the condition codes. Finally, if we just keep sending our opcode through, even though we don't have any more work to do in the memory stage, at that point in time, you know, we can look at the pipeline registers and say, oh, we're doing the memory stage of a jump instruction. That doesn't do anything, but that tells me that we just finished the execute stage of it. And that means that that taken register is set with the right value and the one I should actually use. So this means that given our pipeline registers, we have all the information we need to make that control logic calculation. We didn't have to add some extra register to store what number of stage of the jump instruction are we in. We could have done that. That would work. It's a strategy you're allowed to implement, but it's much easier because we already have the information in our pipeline registers just because we're passing the opcode through. Yeah?
And in this case, the IRMOVEQ, the correct instruction being pulled from instruction memory.
Yes. Yes, the argument queue represents fetching the normal next instruction. Or the correct next instruction, whatever it is. Since this diagram doesn't tell you what we actually, whether we actually took the jump or not. Yeah?
How does Xbox work on something like you take the wrong branch and then just...
We'll get to that later. So our textbook jumps right to something called branch prediction. I'm starting with the simpler thing, and then we're going to add branch prediction to that. Okay, so given that we can look at these pipeline registers to figure out what instruction we're executing, this means that you can actually write that in HCL2D fairly straightforwardly. So to implement that mux, you look at what the I code in the memory stage is, and if it's jump and the branch is taken, you know whether or not to select the jump target or to stall or not, or to go to the normal next instruction, and so on. So any questions about this computation overall? Or stalling to implement the jumps? Yeah, well, let's move on to an easier case. So the other instruction we had trouble with besides conditional jumps was return. And return is actually simpler. For a return, we just don't have anything until the memory stage. So we're just going to take the value from the memory stage, and we're going to use that in the next cycle to figure out what instruction to run. And note that we definitely have to wait to the memory stage, because look at this code here. So we execute call and then immediately execute ret. So in our pipeline, we need to wait until the call instruction enters the memory stage in order for the value that return needs to use to know what instruction to run next to even be available. So there's definitely no way we can finish the return instruction until the following cycle after the call instruction writes to memory. So it might not be this bad in the old cases, but this is the worst case, so this is what we need to handle. So one question you might ask is, well, the value is available in this cycle. Why aren't we just starting the following add queue there right away? And we could do that. We could add this wire here, where we go from the data memory into this logic before the instruction memory to choose what PC, and it would work. So what's the reason why the textbook has chosen not to do this? Or a reason why you think you would choose not to do this? Why is the textbook waiting an extra cycle? So now think about this. Let's look at the path that signals go in the worst from in the case where we use this connection for the rent. So in this case, in a clock cycle, we need to get a signal, a new value out of the pipeline registers for the memory stage, send that to the data memory, and wait for the data memory to produce a value based on the address we sent it, which is going to be the place on the stack where the return value is. So then we get that return value out, and we send it through this logic. And that logic sends it through to the instruction memory. And to complete the cycle, we need to wait for the instruction memory to read the address that we specified from, and then write those values so they're ready to be put into these registers for the decode stage. So what's the problem here? Why don't we want to do this? Yeah. Yeah. So why is what makes it long? Yeah. So it turns out that these two memories here are going to be among the slowest components in our machine. So, and to our clock cycle needs to accommodate the worst case. And if we add this wire, the worst case is that we need to have time for both memories to do a read and a little extra logic. And that's going to be very long. So even though this would make return instructions execute a cycle faster, it's going to make each of those cycles much longer, and that's not going to pay off. And that's why our book didn't do this. So instead, our book has the value be sent from the registers after the data memory. So we spend an extra cycle waiting, but in exchange, we don't have to set our cycle time based on the speed of the memory plus the speed of the other memory. So, and the rest of the logic for the RET is going to be the same as the jump. So we're going to look at the I codes and wait until we see a RET instruction in the write back stage before we actually advance the PC. And when we see a RET instruction in any of these stages, we're not going to send a new RET instruction through the pipeline. We're just going to send that dummy no-op bubble value in order to have nothing happen during those stages while we're waiting for the result of the RET. Yeah?
So the fetch stage, they're going to stall, and everything else is going to put in bubble.
Yeah. Well, we only need to place the bubbles between fetch and decode, because whatever we send to decode will be sent to execute if we don't do anything. Yeah?
So the difference between bubble and stall?
So the stall is where we don't change what instruction we're on, don't change the values of the pipeline registers. So so we're not changing the PC in this case. We're staying on that write instruction. We're not clearing the PC to the start of the program. The bubble is where we're using a default value. So for the registers between fetch and decode, we're using a default value that does nothing. we're not just sending the old instruction before the ret again. And that would be what stalling would do. We don't want to execute the instruction before the ret twice, or try to keep doing it. We can actually let that go through the pipeline. We just want to send something else, and we don't have anything to send. So that's what the bubble is sending, that dummy instruction. It's effectively inserting the no-ops in the cases where we don't just, or where we need to send something. Other questions? I feel like that was not as clear as it could be. Yeah.
So what's wrong with just stalling the decode stage?
So if we look at this timeline, when we're doing this, the decode stage is doing our call. We actually want that to continue. And we don't want to run the call multiple times either. So we don't actually want to stall the call instruction. But in the next cycle, we need to be, so in this cycle, we're stalling the decode stage here, we actually want to run this ret, right? We want it to go through. And we don't want to keep run another ret. We want to run exactly one copy of ret. So if we stalled in the decode stage in cycle 3 here, for example, that would mean on the next cycle, we'd be running ret again in the decode stage. But we don't need to do that. We only want to run one copy of ret. So we want to put something else in its place that doesn't do anything. Yes?
So stalling is always going to happen in the fetch stage, and the other stages are
up to bubble. For now. We will have some cases later on where we might stall in other stages, in addition to the fetch stage, maybe. Or at least real processors will. But for this case, we're only caring about things that we have to do in the fetch stage, which is compute the PC. So that's the only place where we might stall. So let's move on and look at, go on to making our conditional jump implementation better. And to do that, we're going to first look at when things actually happen in our processor, in our pipeline processor. What stage do changes happen? And if we look at things, except for pipeline registers, which clearly are a change, but aren't the normal visible state of the program, the only things which happen are in execute, memory, and write back. In the execute stage, we can change the condition codes. And as an assembly programmer, you could notice if we change the condition codes on you because jumps and conditional moves would behave differently. So that's a visible change outside of pipeline registers. In the memory stage, we might write to memory. In the write back stage, we change our register file and we might change stat. And that's visible. So notice that this means that until an instruction gets to the execute stage and finishes it, it hasn't actually done any changes besides to the pipeline registers. So if we wanted to undo an instruction, as long as it didn't get past the execute stage, we just need to make sure it doesn't change the condition codes in this cycle, the cycle that we know we want to undo it in, and just forget everything in the pipeline registers. Forgetting everything in the pipeline registers, that just means we don't use whatever they're outputting. So as long as we don't use that, and we make sure that the condition codes don't actually get written, we can undo an instruction as long as we know to do that before the execute stage. If you wanted to undo an instruction later, we need to do more work. So if you wanted to undo it in the memory stage, we need to have a backup copy of the condition codes as they existed before that instruction executed. We could do that, but that would be a lot of extra logic. But for just stopping them up to the execute stage, it's actually fairly simple. And we're going to take advantage of this in order to make jumps execute faster if we can only guess what instructions to run next. So let's say we have this conditional jump here, and let's say we're going to guess that it's actually going to go to the label and execute this add and rmove queue. And we could just start executing add and rmove queue. And we know that during the execute stage, we'll figure out whether or not that guess was right. And if it wasn't right, we could undo the effect of the partially executed add queue and arm move queue. And if it's not, we just don't do anything. So if we're right, this means that we're two cycles faster because we started these two instructions earlier. And if we're wrong, we'll just don't do anything, but we won't actually be any slower because we had to wait that amount of time anyways in order to know what instruction to fetch when we were stalling. So the way this timeline is going to look is that we're going to just add speculated instructions where previously we were stalling or putting bubbles, doing nothing. And the way this works, we'll end up executing, you know, we'll confirm our guesses after we actually use the condition codes. And when we're right, we just have actually less work to do. When we're right, we didn't actually need to implement any special logic, really. We just did a normal PC update where we treated it like a call and just unconditionally went to the target. And then we didn't actually need to do anything else. And we've also replaced a bunch of wasted work where we spent time and didn't do anything with useful work. So sometimes we might not be right. So maybe instead of needing to execute this add queue and arm move queue, we'll guess that that has to happen. But actually, we might need it to just go to the next instruction, execute the XOR. So in that case, it's not going to be worse. We're going to start executing the add, then we're going to start executing the arm move queue, and then instead of continuing the execute, instead of running the add stage of the execute stage of the add, we're going to insert a pipeline bubble. We're going to put the no-op thing instructions there. Instead of executing the decode stage of the arm move queue, we're going to insert a pipeline bubble. We're going to execute a no-op there. And we're going to actually fetch the real next instruction and start executing it. And because we did this early enough, we're not going to have to worry about having cases where we were executing the wrong instruction. And we're seeing the effects of these wrong instructions. So we won't have to worry that this add overwrote the condition codes and we're going to notice on a following jump. That's not going to be a problem. And this process of inserting pipeline bubbles in the place of instructions that we started executing but went to get rid of is called squashing sometimes. So we take these wrong guesses and just get rid of them out of the pipeline. So besides the extra logic to squash instructions, this isn't actually any slower than what we were doing before. We're still spending the same number of cycles waiting for the answer. We just happen to be faster in the cases when we can guess right. So any questions on this guess and check scheme? Yeah?
So do you always, if you're right, you don't squash anything, but if you're wrong, you always squash two, or?
It's based on when you figure out what the actual outcome is and when you can figure that out. So if you figure it out later, you need to squash more.
Oh, if you figure it out in memory, then you have to squash it three.
Yeah, so if you, it's when you know that you have to suppress it. And as we mentioned, if you actually let something finish the execute stage, you're in trouble because it might have changed the condition codes.
Yes, yeah, so how do we avoid it?
So the way we are going to avoid that in this class is by making sure we don't speculate that far ahead. The way that's avoided in real processors is by keeping extra copies of things like the condition codes to restore. So, as I said, this simplifies our logic for the actual PC update for the most part. It might be a little more complicated for doing that squashing, finding those instructions we weren't supposed to be executing because our guess was wrong. So this tells us a scheme of making things faster, and I just arbitrarily, and the book arbitrarily, chose a guess that we would assume that this is taken, that we would go to the label. And we didn't have to choose that. We could have guessed that we'd go to the XOR instead. That's perfectly fine to do. But the book did have a reason to choose that. And one reason is that's going to make things simpler. So handling unconditional jumps is the same as handling conditional jumps in this logic. Because for an unconditional jump, you just assume it's taken and you're always right. And you're exactly as fast. So it simplifies it in that sense. So that's a reason to use it. But a bigger reason to use it is that it's actually, if you're choosing between guessing it's always taken or never taken, this is actually the best guess, just based on empirical observations of programs. So people have done studies of real programs and figured out what portion of the branches are taken or not taken. And whenever they've done this, they found out that a significant majority of branches are taken, something like 60%. This obviously doesn't have to be the case. You can write programs where no branches are taken. You can easily construct that. If you want to make this branch prediction scheme look really bad, you can write that program where you just, you know, set the condition codes to something and then have a whole like sequence of branches which are never taken. But that's not what real programs do. And there's an intuition for why real programs usually take branches. And that's the way that a compiler is going to typically want to write a loop. The minimum number of instructions for a loop is to put the jump for the loop at the end. And that means it's going to be a conditional jump. And if the loop has lots of iterations, it's going to be taken most of the time. So if this loop here has 100 iterations, so this branch at the end is taken 99% of the time. And it is likely that the prevalence of loops as being most of our branches, in the sense of most of the ones we execute, not most of the ones in our programs, is the reason why this strategy works so well. Where so well is like 60, 70%, but that's still pretty good. It's better than coin flip. So let's say I wanted to figure out how much faster branch prediction made my processor. What information should I need to know to do that? So I've told you that we're usually making the right guesses and that we execute correctly predicted conditional jumps 2 cycles faster. What else do I want to know? Yeah?
We need to know how fast it was before.
Okay. So we need to know how fast it was before. So I said it was 2 cycles faster. Is that enough? 2 cycles faster for conditional jumps. Is that enough information to make a good conclusion about whether how much faster it is if I wanted to tell someone my processor is X percent faster? So probably not, because you can't think of an X percent based on conditional jumps are 2 cycles faster. So what else do we need to know? In what form do we want to know what the performance was before the change? Ratio? So ratio measured on what? So we're probably going to measure time, but the time of what? So we need to have some program in mind, often called like a benchmark. We need to have some program in mind because it really matters what program we're running. If I want to make our branch prediction look really bad, I can write a program where I deliberately construct it to have no correctly predicted branches. And then it will look like our processor with branch prediction is as bad as our one without. Though clearly that's not the case. And if I want to make it look really good, I can write a program where every branch is predicted correctly, even though that's not going to be typical of real programs. So we're going to need to actually have an idea of what a real program looks like. And in the real world, you do this by finding programs and measuring what they do. And the thing you're looking for in order to make this performance comparison is what types of instructions do they execute. So you might end up with a table like this, where you take the different kinds of instructions you care about. So we care about whether conditional jumps are taken or not taken versus and how many returns there are, because that slows our processor down, and versus all the other instructions, which for now, we're assuming we can run in a single cycle. And we can say, well, how fast is it when we implemented branch prediction? So with branch prediction, non-taken, incorrectly guessed branches are 3 cycles. It's 3 cycles until we can issue the next instruction, that is. They obviously take more time to go through the pipeline, because the pipeline is 5 stages. But this is the time until we can issue the next instruction. When they're taken and guessed correctly, that's 1 cycle, where previously it was 3. For returns, we're going to take 4 cycles, no matter whether or not we have branch prediction, because we can't do anything about the returns. Yeah, we know that's taken. We know it's not going to the normal next instruction, but we don't know anything else useful until we read memory. And for everything else, we're going to assume it's 1. And we can use this mix of instructions and how many cycles it takes under each case to figure out what the average time per instruction would be, assuming our programs look like this. So we say, okay, 3% of the instructions are these things which take 3 cycles, plus 5% are the things which take 1. So we multiply the percentage times the number of cycles, add them together, get this weighted average. And the total quantity we get is the average number of cycles that each instruction takes as far as throughput is concerned. So with prediction and this mix of instructions, our processor can execute 1.09 cycles to execute each instruction. And if we just stall instead of predicting, it takes 1.19 cycles to execute each instruction on average. So assuming our programs look like this, we have about a 10% performance improvement. And this general technique is what we're going to be concerned most about over the next few weeks. We're going to be looking at ways we can drive this number down to the ideal, which is 1. We're also going to be looking at reasons that we haven't talked about, why this number is higher, why this 1 here and 1 here aren't really 1. Why it's going to actually take us a little more than a cycle to execute other instructions when we talk about data hazards and how memories actually work. But most of what we're going to talk about for the rest of the semester, including what we talked about today with branch prediction, is about driving this number, this number, down closer and closer to 1, which is the fastest we can possibly be, because that's the ideal case, is that we execute a new instruction every cycle. And this is also something real processors are very focused on. So it's not just how fast can you make the clock speed, but how many instructions can you actually execute after you have to deal with things like figuring out where a branch goes to. And you often end up with cases where, for real processors, for example, often instead of the ideal number being 1, they have some fancy logic to do multiple instructions at a time, so it's 1/4. But often the real CPIs you'll see on a processor where the ideal is 1/4 will be like 1.2. It is that bad that you might be running like 5 times slower than the ideal. So all these techniques become much more important as you try to fit more in a cycle. And there are lots of techniques, some of which we'll talk about, some of which we won't, which are all focused on bringing this number down. So the other side of the performance equation that we're not talking about is how long are these cycles? So I mentioned that with why we need to have the return value come from a register after the data memory, not data memory directly, because we're concerned about the cycle time. And there's other things we're going to be doing which might affect our cycle time. We don't talk about hardware in enough detail to actually compute what those times would be, but you should be aware that there's complexity is going to affect what that cycle time needs to be, and that also affects our performance. But that's mostly not what we'll be looking at. We'll be instead looking at the number of cycles each instruction takes, assuming that we're not changing that cycle time very much. Okay. So any questions about this performance equation or measuring performance in general? So let's think about, so I was talking about real processors. So this is a case where, you know, when I talked last time about pipelining, we talked about pipelining increasing latency. And this is a case where that latency is a problem. Because that latency is showing up in how long we have to wait to actually get the result of a branch. That number of cycles. And that's showing, that's the increased latency of our pipeline showing up. And this means that if we made our pipeline longer, which pretty much all real processors do, we'll have a larger penalty, and we'll increase our cycles per instruction more, and decrease our overall performance potentially, depending on whether or not we can increase the clock rate enough to hide that. And famously, in 2000, Intel released a processor which was very aggressive about using a very deep pipeline called the Pentium 4. And on release, it had a 50% higher clock rate than its competitors. So AMD was selling 1 gigahertz chips, and Intel was selling a 1.5 gigahertz chip. But to do this, it made the pipeline much deeper. It had a 2 to 3 times deeper pipeline. Numbers vary, but its pipeline was something between 20 and 30 stages. Which meant that when they couldn't predict the branch, the penalty was quite high. And combined with some other factors, the overall result was that this didn't work out very well. So here's a quote from a review of this newly released Pentium 4. "For today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. It's more expensive," and there was also some other bad choices with the memory system that made it less convenient. So eventually the Pentium 4 wasn't as bad when they increased the clock rate more. But this is where we pay for trying to make our pipeline shorter. This is where that latency actually shows up. And because this penalty matters more with a deeper pipeline, this also means that modern processors spend a lot of more effort on branch prediction than we're ever going to do in this class. Yeah?
Did it have a really high throughput?
So its ideal case was substantially better, yes. So its ideal performance and its performance on some benchmarks was a lot better. This is also a case where you can really choose benchmarks to make a processor look good or not. Right? So if you ran typical old programs, they wouldn't work very well because they'd suffer from this penalty from, say, branch misprediction. If you had really good programs, they'd be really good at exploiting all the features the processor had, which included executing more math operations at a time. So it could be a lot faster. The end user did not really like it because their programs were programs which were designed to run on previous processors. It wasn't until substantially later that programs would actually be built to use the new processor. And the end game for this story is that the Pentium 4 was around for a while, but Intel's next processors were based on a previous version of their microarchitecture because they decided that this deeper pipeline was not worth it. So they reverted back to when they released the Core processor that was based on the revised version of the Pentium 3 architecture in order to have not as deep a pipeline and not have as much of this problem. Okay. But Pentium 4 wasn't being silly about doing this. Their main miscalculation is that they assumed in development that they could increase the clock rate more than they could. And part of dealing with these longer pipelines is that they had much more complicated branch prediction than we have. So on a typical modern processor, there's probably more space on the processor devoted to doing branch prediction than, say, multiplying and dividing integers. It's that important, that much effort. There's a whole lot of effort in doing branch prediction, and it's also one of the least documented parts of processors. Yeah?
How many stages does a modern processor?
It varies, probably, and it depends how you count. So counting stages is not as straightforward in modern processors because the pipeline is like split and some instructions go through more stages than others. So there's not like an easy answer, but it's probably around 15 to 20, typically. But it depends how you count. So you could come up with counts which are like 25 and not be crazy. Other questions? So there are simple things we could do to dramatically improve our branch prediction. So we're assuming that all branches are taken, but there's a simple to implement strategy, which is much more accurate, which is to assume that forward branches, branches to an address which is greater than our current program counter, are not taken, and branches to an address which is less than our current program counter, that is backwards branches, are taken. And again, there's no reason why this must be true. You can write a program where every forward branch is taken and every backwards branch is not taken. If you want to make this look bad, you can do it. But when people have empirically looked at programs, this is usually true. And intuition for why this happens, again, comes from loops. So there are two ways to write loops. So one of them is you have, as before, a jump at the end of the loop that's conditional, and it's usually taken. Every time that loop is executed, which is presumably more than one time, that's taken. So most of the time, that branch is taken. You can also check the condition at the beginning of the loop. And if you do that, you'll have a forwards branch. And in the loop, usually that won't be taken because we execute the loop multiple times. So that is our intuition for why forwards might not be taken. But again, you can construct programs where this isn't true. This is more that people have looked at a whole lot of programs and found that usually this is the case. And so this is probably about the best scheme for the instruction set we have for predicting branches without any extra information for conditional jumps. And real processors are going to actually keep around some extra state to do that. They're going to have tables about what happened previously and all sorts of complicated things like that. Because with this scheme, you might get around 80 to 90% accuracy. In a real processor, they want to predict branches correctly like 95, 98% of the time to have good performance. Yeah?
So would real processors like cache previous results of jumps to help predict their future behavior?
So there are a variety of schemes, but they mostly kind of look like caching previous results. Yes. So this is a dealing with conditional jumps. So one case we had where we couldn't do anything about was returns. We couldn't do anything about predicting returns. But it turns out that real processors actually try to fetch the thing for the return immediately. And clearly, we don't have a way of doing that yet without keeping some extra data around. And that's exactly what the real processors do. And so what they do is that their call instruction writes to memory. It writes a return address to memory. But it also writes a copy of that return address to a second stack that's kept in fast CPU registers. And on the return instruction executing, the processor takes an address off this and uses that as its guess. So there might be some cases where it doesn't actually agree with what's on the real stack, because maybe you set the return address with something other than the call instruction. You could have written the value to the stack instead. So it's not always wrong, right, but that's fine, because we'll fix up the guess if we detect that when we actually read the value from memory, it disagrees with what was on the processor's internal stack. But this is commonly used, and this means that even for returns, which we can't handle, with this extra logic, you can usually predict them correctly and get much closer to that one cycle per instruction by not having that four-cycle penalty for every return, which is going to add up even if returns are pretty rare. And another thing real processors do related to this is that their instruction fetches don't have a single cycle instruction memory. So it turns out that they need to predict before fetch. I'm just bringing this up because I think from our prior discussion you might get the wrong idea about what branch prediction is, that you look at the instruction. But real processors need to do it without looking at the instruction. So they need to have some information they've collected from how instructions ran before in order to make a guess. And that's usually how branch prediction works. It's not actually looking at the instruction. To make at least the first guess. And we're not going to mention how these schemes work, but I just want you to be aware that you you do branch prediction before you get the opcode. If your instruction fetch takes too long, you have to. Okay, so today we talked about sort of the overall scheme for taking our single cycle processor and turning it into a pipeline processor. By adding pipeline registers and by fixing up how we executed control flow instructions, making it so we executed conditional jumps and doing branch prediction in the common case. And for cases where we couldn't do any branch prediction of RET, we had logic for stalling by looking at the opcode registers until the RET instruction got to read its value from memory, in which case we used it. And we talked about how this made our processor slower than our ideal one instruction every cycle. So next time, we're going to just talk about dealing with other data hazards in a way that's better than stalling, and all the details of all that control flow logic related to that.